Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Before we pop our corks, could I ask you a huge favour? If you don't already follow us, would you hit the follow button and give us a follow? You see the three little dots at the top right hand of your screen? Just tap that, hit the follow show tab. It's the first on the drop down menu. And ta-da! That means two things. One, you're never going to miss an episode. And two, it really does help us to bring you the very best guests there are out there. Speaking of which, on with the show. Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest this week is an English actress who's been a star of the big and small screen for over 20 years now, having starred alongside genuine screen legends like Lauren Bacall, Angelica Houston, Rupert Everett, Claire Danes and Jeremy Piven, and yet all the while managing to maintain a very quiet life. Born and raised in Orpington in Kent, she discovered a passion for acting after her neighbours introduced her to amateur theatre at the age of 12. Gripped by the arts, she went on to study at London's Central School of Drama and literally just days after graduating started shooting on her first film. It was called Stage Beauty. She played Nell Gwynn opposite Rupert Everett, Claire Danes and Billy Crudup. Her success continued with roles on shows like Survivors, Rules of the Game, Demons, Liar and Mr. Selfridge. But it was in 2021 with the Netflix sci-fi drama The One that she gained international success. Whilst being a very familiar face on our TV screens, her work also extends to the theatre, where she starred in the West End as well as appearing in Othello at Shakespeare's Globe. In 2008, she married her husband, fellow actor Oliver Dimsdale, and they are parents to Ava, who's 12, and Otto, who's 8. And now we're about to see her back on our screens as she returns for the third season of ITV's crime thriller Grace alongside John Sim in the adaptation of the Peter James novels. I can't wait to talk to her. I'll tell you why when she says hello. It's Zoe Tapper.
Hello. Oh, how lovely. My goodness me. That's like a... This is your life in condensed into 30 seconds. How wonderful. I thank goodness I've actually done some things. I was thinking, what have I actually done in my life? And I have. Great.
You know, this is so exciting, Zoe, because literally when the call came through to say, would you like to have Zoe Tapper on the podcast? Both myself and Maria, the producer of this show, went, oh, yeah, we know Zoe. And of course, we don't. And yet we do, because we've spent lockdown together. Every day we spent an hour together in lockdown. And will you explain how? But this is so exciting to see your actual face.
There is a very special club that we are a part of. And it is the Sort Your Fit Out Club, run by the magnificent Richie Swan. And yes, I came across it in lockdown. I like, you know, half the population grew a little bit softer over lockdown. And and I think it was like, you know, the final lockdown when I just couldn't drink any more wine, couldn't eat any more crisps. I thought I might have to do something about it. And I saw it was actually Tamsin Althwaite's post, I think, on Instagram, posting this online class that she was doing. And I thought, oh, that looks okay. Perhaps I can do that. So it was a short class, 40 minutes. Maybe I can drag my sorry ass out off the sofa. And so I did. I joined Rich's class and I have not looked back. I do it, you know, I try and do it as often as I can. It's a brilliant online live class. And yeah, I've stuck to it, which I never do. I hate exercise. So it's been revelatory, actually. Yeah.
Shall I explain to you how I know Richie?
Yes, go on then.
So I know Richie because I met him at Heidi Range's hen weekend, where he was a one of her best friends because he used to work on check-in for EasyJet at Liverpool Airport, John Lennon Airport, with her sister, right? He was also a part-time butler in the Buff.
I know this about him. I know this and I love it. It couldn't be more perfect. What an amazing butler in the Buff, I bet he was.
And so when he started in lockdown, said, I'm going to do these Rich's Kitchen. We set up this WhatsApp group, me and my mates. So me, Heidi, got Tamsin involved, you know, Emma Bunton, lots and lots of people that people might, whose name they might recognise, as well as all of our other mates, you know. And just we're all doing this every day at 10 a.m. We log on and it's a way for us all to be together and literally offset the wine that we're now drinking come sort of like the 5 o'clock press briefings onwards. And that's how it all began. And I loved it. And it was a reason to get up every day. It was a reason to be somewhere on time.
Yeah. It was that sense of community when you felt like you were losing your community. But it was also, I mean, he's the genius behind it, isn't he? Because he's got such an infectious personality. And,
it's hilarious.
You know,
by the way, anyone can join. It's not just like some sort of secret members club.
No, it isn't. It's like, I think it sends the right message as well. It's not about just going, let's lose a few pounds. It's actually about going, let's start our day as we mean to go on. Let's be positive. Let's be body positive. Let's be mind positive. And I've sort of become addicted to it. It's sort of an addiction now because it's a little burst of exercise, you know, as many times as I can do it. And he gives me a pep talk and I leave the class thinking, oh, I can do anything. I can achieve anything. He's wonderful. You should all join.
But what I do remember in lockdown when your Netflix show, the most watched show, it was called The One, on Netflix, and I remember us all kind of scrabbling to post comments on the live going, well done, Zoe. It was like, so here we are meeting for the first time, and you've not even met Richie in real life, have you?
I've not met Richie in real life. I have been on his podcast during lockdown. I think when I was doing The One, he got me on his podcast, but I'm sure we will meet at some stage. Perhaps we will all meet at some stage.
Absolutely.
In the flesh.
I'd love that.
Yeah,
I would so love that. Because we have, you know, even within the group on Sort Your Fit Out, there are friends that we have in common. And last night I sat and watched the brand new, I was very lucky to get a preview of the new season of Grace.
Yes.
Oh my God, it scared the bejesus out of me to the point that I did that thing of like walking upstairs last night, checking all the rooms were empty and there was nobody in a gas mask under my bed.
Well, listen, I don't even really watch it when it goes out because even though I've been in them and I know the stories and I've read the scripts, I can't watch them either. They're really scary, aren't they? I'm no good with anything that is sort of potentially hiding and ready to jump out at you. So, they're dark.
They're dark and they're gripping. They're film. They're kind of feature length. They're 90 minutes, aren't they? They're not, it's not, you know, it's not a sort of Midsummer's Murder vibe where everything's sewn up neatly in an hour. It's 90 minutes. You're on the edge of your seat. And you're playing the love interest of John Sims. And yet his lovely wife, Kate McGowan, is also in Sort Your Fit Out. She's
all
one
the
of
best
our
people
classmates.
Are. All the best people are. What can I say? I know. We're all connected now. It's what is it? 6 degrees of SIFO. That's what we should all be called.
That's what we call it, yeah. Because they've moved down to Brighton, haven't they?
They have, yes.
Is it for this show? Because John's always kind of shooting.
Yeah, I don't know if they actually moved for the show. I think it was a sort of serendipitous happenstance that occurred. I think he filmed the first series, which I wasn't a part of. And then I think they were already planning to move down there. So he then moved down and you know, how lovely. He gets to roll out bed onto set, which is dreamy.
And it is a nice part of the world, isn't it?
It's lovely. And every time I go to Brighton, it feels... Part of me goes, I really want to go and live there now. And I think John Sim is trying to encourage the entire cast to actually do that. my home is very much in London, and I'm a born and bred London girl, but I have to say, I shouldn't say this, but it does feel like a bit of a holiday when I go down there, because I get to just pop down to Brighton for a few days, stay in a hotel on my own, which is blissful. You know, I've got two young children at home. It sometimes feels quite nice to escape and be by the sea and then go and film, do a lovely job with wonderful people. And it's a treat. It's a real treat.
It's a really big show as well, isn't it, Grace? I mean, this is your big blockbuster, 9 o'clock, you know, lead dramas.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I think it's, I don't really keep abreast of all the sort of ratings and things, but I know that ITV are very happy with it. And I think it's, you know, up there with one of their sort of top watch shows. And I think it's a bit of gold dust, really, because they're based on the Peter James books.
And so
Peter James obviously has an enormous fan base from the off. So we just had to just not mess it up, really. we already knew that they were going to be successful. People love those books. They read them in their droves. And so we just had to honour them and do the best that we could. And that was a daunting prospect, because I think, you know, for people who do love the books, they all had an idea of who these characters were already. And we had to sort of slightly change their minds and sort of find them ourselves. But I hope they warmed to us.
Oh, they're so good. To the point that I watched the first one, not last night, the night before, the preview of season three. And then I went back and started from the very beginning last night.
How did you?
And I got as far as you coming along, chopping up bodies, and then, frankly, getting all smoochy-coochy with John.
I know. She works quite quickly, old Cleo Morey. She doesn't hang around.
She doesn't muck about, does she?
She knows what she wants.
Dissecting a dead body. The next minute, she's literally getting a freak on.
Well, I know. I mean, she gets her man in her sights and she goes for it. So good on her.
Now, for the purposes of today's podcast, for this episode, I've tried to devise three questions for you, all of which brings me really nicely to my first question. Shall we?
Okay.
Now, as I've mentioned, you and I have actually never met in person. And yet, I feel like we've had a shared experience, because we lived through quite a monumental moment in our lives and history when we came together to work out in lockdown online. It was arguably the strangest of times and a connection which bonded all of us in that group. But I wondered, where else in life have you built connections with people in the most unlikely of places?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because the mainstay of my career, my job, is a world where I meet, you know, 100 new people every time I start a new job, and so in some respects, that I suppose that makes me think that that's the obvious answer to go. You know, I meet these people, you fall very quickly into friendships with people you've never met before, and in situations that you've never been in before, but probably in a more sort of meaningful way, in some respects, for me, the community that I've found that's had a sort of a different sort of impact on my life has been around my campaigns to do with mental health and maternal mental illness, actually. And that all stems from my experiences as a mother and my experiences with maternal mental illness as a mother. And that's kind of led me into a really unexpected direction that I never could have foreseen. And it's also a direction that for a long time I wasn't comfortable talking about at all.
Yeah.
And now I really love to talk about, because it's something that I feel really, really passionately about. So, just to give you a little bit of a backdrop to that, when I had my daughter almost 12 years ago, I almost immediately post-birth had crippling postnatal depression. And at the time, 12 years ago...
That's so hard.
I know. It is really hard, really, really tough. And so many women go through it.
Yeah.
And at that time, even 12 years ago, it wasn't something that anybody really talked about. And certainly wasn't something I was aware of or had any sort of thoughts about. I was so ready to be a mum, and I was so geared up for it. I had a wonderful support system. And so it hit me like a sledgehammer. And I couldn't actually access the help that I needed at all. And so by hook or by crook, I got better, but I didn't really recover from it properly psychologically, because I couldn't talk about it. I couldn't re-express it. I didn't have a forum to do it in, and I didn't have the people supporting me that I needed to sort of work through those very complicated feelings. And then I found an organization called Mum's Aid. It was a local organization, a brilliant woman, a saint, an angel called Miriam Donaghy, who runs it. And she was doing it at that point. She was at quite a low ebb herself. She'd hurt her back. She had been trying to forge forward with this organization that was supporting women with maternal mental illness. She'd recognized the dearth in support for those women, but she couldn't get the funding. She couldn't get the help. She couldn't get anybody to talk about it. And at the time, you know, I was a new mum. I had sort of physically recovered from my experiences of postnatal depression, but I was probably still not, you know, my true sort of vibrant, full self. But I just felt like I wanted to find people that I could talk to about it. And she, I said to her, look, I'll do anything. I'll volunteer. I'll, you know, hand out flyers. What can I do? Give me a purpose. Give me something to, because I felt so strongly that if I was suffering from this, and with all the people who supported me around me, there must be other women out there who didn't have that support and were on their own. And so we actually, it was what was fundamentally obvious was that we needed money to kind of set this business really and this organization going, and actually to employ the people that we needed to employ. So we started writing grants and bids, and we proposed a bid for children in need, because we reasoned that this directly affected children. If the mother's not well, and is unable to look after the child to the best of their abilities, then it has a direct impact on children. And so brilliantly, Children in Need recognised this and gave us some funding, and not just some funding, but they really sort of covered all of the expenses that we needed to run the organisation. And wow. for a prolonged period of time, I think it was going to be reviewed after 3 years. And so, you know, I don't take the credit for that. Miriam absolutely spearheaded all of it, but I just sort of, you know, helped write the grant and kind of supported her. And then slowly but surely, it has grown and grown and grown and grown, this organisation, and is now a wonderful resource. And particularly in lockdown, actually, it grew even bigger, because at first it was just a very much a London-centric organisation. And then through lockdown, when you could actually start reaching out to people online, it became a sort of nationwide thing. And they provide free counselling services, free psychotherapy, peer support groups. There's now a sort of sister group called Young Mums Aid, which specifically supports young women with mental health difficulties after birth and during pregnancy. And it's a brilliant, brilliant organisation. And actually, funnily enough, or not funnily enough, when I had my second child, little Otto, it all happened again to me. I had another dreadful bout of postnatal depression again, which was, you know, just as bad and just as, you know, debilitating. But at least I had, knowledge is power. And at least at that point, I had the knowledge at my fingertips, and I knew who to turn to. I knew where to go, and I knew that I would recover from it. And ever since then, and I recovered from that, and I did, and I've thrived ever since, and I've got wonderful children, and I love being a mom. But in terms, going back to your original question, in terms of finding that sort of community, that unexpected community, that really probably is that community for me.
What a lifeline for women that are so held hostage by the hormonal shift that occurs at a time like that, where you can sit and look at your life really intelligently and go, why am I not happy? Everything's fine. I've got a great support network. My baby's healthy.
Yeah.
It makes no sense. And that's the hardest part. Can I ask, how did you recover from that? Because I think other women would find that so helpful. And we've had other guests on the show, like Kate Lawler and Denise Welsh, sharing very similar experiences with you know, for Denise, it developed into clinical depression. For Kate, it was something that she was able to recover from, you know, without it becoming clinical depression. Mm. Everybody's experience is different, I guess.
Every experience is different. And I think and that's what's so difficult for people to understand sometimes, because I think it's such a mixture of circumstance, psychological, chemical, physical,
yeah,
things that all kind of come together. And so there's no one, you know, I thought second time round, there was no way I was going to get it again. In fact, I spoke to one sort of mental health expert who told me, I'm 90% convinced you're not going to get it again. Because by the second time I was, you know, I had everything in place. I had the mental health team behind me. I'd given everybody warning. I was going to do this and this and this differently. And of course, it was very quick. It wasn't a sort of, some women, it takes a long time. It sort of slowly builds and they build and they realize that they've not been happy for a long time and they're not coping. Whereas mine was literally 2 weeks after birth, I'm suddenly like a zombie on the sofa. I mean, it was so extraordinary. And this was coming from somebody who hadn't really experienced any kind of mental health difficulties in the past. And it is a particularly bitter pill to swallow, because we are led as a society and as women to believe that we are going to be at our happiest in those early years with babies, and that motherhood is the ultimate, you know, the ultimate quest, and we're going to enjoy it more than anything else in our lives. And when you can't fulfill that, or you feel like a failure and you feel like you're less than and you're not a good mother, and it's, you know, it's a terrible sort of self-flagellating kind of experience.
Yeah.
In terms of how I got over it, or how I recovered, the first time around, not well, because as I said, I didn't get the right help. And so I saw a very kind GP who was very nice to me, but didn't have the specific knowledge that I needed to kind of support me through it. So I just took the medication. I took the pills, which I'm an advocate of, don't get me wrong. I think the pills are great. Like, take the pills if you need to take the pills. But I would also say...
These are antidepressants, yeah.
Antidepressants, yeah.
Yeah.
But I would also say they need to be in conjunction with other forms of therapy as well, because what happened very clearly with me in that first instance was that I recovered physically, and I thought I'd recovered mentally because the chemicals in my brain had sort of evened out. But the trauma of it, and I'd had a very traumatic birth, and I'd also the trauma of those early months not being what I thought they were going to be, and the thought that I'd sort of lost that and then lost that time, stayed with me and sort of haunted me, actually, and still to this day in some respects, and I've worked through it a lot now, but I still get haunted by that sometimes when I look back over that time.
It's so precious, isn't it? And you must feel like it robbed you of a moment that you had been led to believe was going to be amongst the most glorious of your life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you just want it to be picture perfect. So we've got this. And I particularly, I suppose, have always been somebody who is slightly too driven to kind of be a perfectionist. And I thought, I was going to be that mother who's got it all sorted, that can do everything, that can work, that can be the mum, that can do. And when it was very evident that I was not going to be that, it was hard. And also just the sort of loss of those early months to this illness, actually. You know, I do look back at those times. I can see it in my eyes. I can see the pictures from those times.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was still there. I was still looking after my baby, loving my baby, obsessively loving my baby, actually, really. But I was sort of broken inside, and it took me a long time to recover that. But the second time round, I did still take medication, but I took it in conjunction with talking therapy, and I talked it through, and that's the secret, and that's why I now talk about it so much, and I can talk about it so much. There would have been a time when I wouldn't have been able to talk about this without sobbing, and I can talk about it now because it's so freeing to speak the truth about things.
Well, if you keep it quiet and you don't share it, A, you're not working it out for yourself, and B, it becomes like a shame, and there is no shame in mental health.
No,
and feeling like you're on the floor, you know, if you are literally like a zombie on the sofa,
Yeah.
There is no shame attached to that.
Well, there is no shame, and there shouldn't be any shame. And I think we've moved on so much, and I see, you know, now that the support that's out there for women, I see actually even just, I know social media gets a battering at times for, you know, and sometimes for good reason, but actually there are support networks on the social media that are like lifelines for women as well. Yeah. And I think it has and is changing, but the advice I got 12 years ago when, you know, when faced with this complete wall of uncertainty and I was, you know, go for a jog and read a book and don't you love your child? That's what I was asked. You know, that's what I was faced with. And you know, now I think back to that and I think what an awful insensitive thing to say. And I'm sure those experiences still sometimes happen, but I think it's changing. Thank goodness.
And conversations like this really help to move the dial on that. Yeah.
Absolutely. If I'd been able to sit there 12 years ago and listen to this sort of a conversation, it would have been such a relief to know that, you know, there are other people out there, and one in five women will have maternal mental illness during pregnancy or after birth. So there are a lot of women. And, you know, and I see it with you as well. I see it with you and your amazing friends and groups of women who are now being so vocal about the menopause and talk. Yeah. That's another sort of milestone in the sort of history of women that we have to sort of overcome, that we need to talk about these things as women, these huge events in our lives that happen that we'll all experience. And it's amazing.
And it is a huge event in your life, as is having a baby. And you're right. I think it's so much of it is, like you said, information is power. Just that stat you gave there, one in five women will struggle with their mental health after having a baby. I believe one in four pregnancies will end in miscarriage. Nobody tells us this stuff. So we skip into these experiences, these huge chapters in life, with some sort of Disney idea about what they're going to play out like. And it kind
and
of...
the shock to the system when it happens, if you've had no prior knowledge or warning.
Yeah.
And again, I feel furious
that I didn't know about the menopause and that I wasn't prepared for it.
Of course.
I feel absolutely livid. And now I walk around like some sort of woman with a sandwich board on my head telling everyone about it. And that's boring for people, you know.
Unless it's not boring for people, then it's
everything.
And it's wonderful. And, you know... And I'm the same, you know, given any opportunity, there I am talking about maternal mental illness. I just feel like we just have to open up these conversations continuously. Mm. And then, you know, the next generation of young women coming forward will still have battles, no doubt, but they won't have to fight the shame and the guilt that a lot of the women that have come before have had to fight. And it's just so important.
It really is. Well, thank you for talking that through with us, because I know without even with every fibre of my being that would be hugely helpful to so many listeners. So thanks, Zoe.
Are
you ready for your next one?
Yes.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Thank you.
You discovered a genuine passion for acting as a young child after your neighbours introduced you to amateur dramatics. And when you sat down and explained to your parents that you were going to turn down an offer from York University to read English, instead to take a place at drama school, your mum gave you a very sound piece of advice. She said, never have a plan B. She told you, stick to plan A, because if you have a plan B, you'll ultimately fall back on it. So how and when has that advice served you well? And what are the wise words of wisdom have been passed down to you that have proved to be just as valuable?
Isn't that brilliant? I still love that so much. And I still go back to that. And funnily enough, even the other day, I was a friend of mine's a teacher, and she asked me to do a Zoom with her drama students. And I sat there with them, and, you know, I can't believe I've been doing this for 20 years, because I still feel the same age as those drama students. And so I was thinking, oh yeah, I do have something to say about this. I do have experience. I do have knowledge to impart. And I gave them that exact advice that that in my experience, it's not always useful to have a plan B. And I know that goes against the grain a little bit. I think a lot of people, especially when their children are looking to go into the arts or in that sort of creative business, there's an instinct as a parent to worry about that, because it does seem we're fed the belief that it's an unstable profession.
Which it is.
But I would argue that most professions these days are unstable.
Yeah.
I mean,
show me a job for life and I'll show you a unicorn.
Well, exactly. So, you know, so I think more than ever, actually, even more than when, you know, when I was at school, certainly no one was encouraging me to be an actor. All of my teachers were saying, you know, do that as a sideline, do that in your amateur dramatics company, but, you know, get yourself a degree. And I'm sure had I gone to York and studied English, I'm sure I would have had a wonderful time, but I still would have wanted to be an actress.
Yeah.
And I would have just been a bit further down the line. And also I didn't really know any other way of getting into the industry other than going to drama school, because, you know, no one really in my family is a part of that world. So the fact that my mum did turn around against all odds, really, to say, go for it, like, I want you to go for plan A all the way, was such a gift. It's such a gift as a child to be told that. And
it really is, isn't it? Because it says, I believe in you. And also, you know, if it doesn't work out, come home, we'll reconfigure.
Yeah. Because we're your fallback position. Yeah. You know, like, you don't need to fall back on anything else, because we're here for you, and there will always be another route, but we should always aim for plan A, you know. And so even to this day, you know, sometimes when I'm chatting to mum, and, you know, who, by the way, is the wisest woman that I've ever met, she will still say, are we on plan A? And I'm like, yep, we're on plan A.
Oh, crazy. So that really had that one piece of advice has really, really stayed with A, you both, and B, also, you're now paying it forward to a whole breed of new up-and-coming aspiring actors.
Yeah, and of course, to my own children, because, you know, there's nothing... I love what I do. I'm sure you love what you do.
I do.
Most people I meet in our industry love what they do. That's such a precious thing. And
it's a privilege, because that's not the case for everybody.
It really isn't. And so, you know, and obviously... people have different routes in, and it's not easy for everybody, and we have to work harder to make sure those channels are open to absolutely everybody. But who am I not to then pass that gift on to my children? You know, I have to. And so, you know, I think there's also this sort of slightly funny sensibility sometimes where people say to me with, you know, regards to my children, like, oh, you know, two actors as parents, are you worried that they're going to want to go into the profession? And I'm like, I'm not worried at all. You know, if that's what they want to do, I'm with them every step of the way, because I love it. If, you know, yes, there's insecurity. Yes, there are times, challenging times, but, you know, that's true of any profession that you're in. So, yes, that was a wonderful, wonderful, valuable piece of advice that I definitely stuck to. And, you know, should I ever win a BAFTA, that'll be in my BAFTA speech.
Good.
That's when I'm pretending in the bathroom mirror with my shampoo bottle. That's what that's what I'm saying to all those people who never gave me a job. I stuck to plan A.
That's brilliant, Zoe.
I'm trying to think of other words of wisdom that I stick by. I think I'm saying it right. I think one of the things I remember the wonderful Michelle Obama saying was that we can have it all, but just not all at once. And I think that speaks volumes to me. Again, I think, you know, I was probably slightly naive growing up in the sort of being a teenager in the 90s and the early 2000s, thinking, I'm going to do it all. I'm going to be a mother. I'm going to be a career woman. I'm going to be this. I'm going to be that. And of course, all those things, I am all of those things. But they all, you know, sometimes those things happen in stages. And it is very, very, I think the pressure for the juggle is still very real. And I think that pressure on women to have it all is still really, really intense. And I think that's a better version of it, that you can have it all, but just perhaps not all at once. I think that's a good thing to remind yourself sometimes.
I think so as well. Yeah, absolutely right. Not all of the time. Even if you're the first lady.
Even if you're the first lady, there you go. I mean, it doesn't get much better.
Before we move on from this, there was something whispered in your ear by the legendary Lauren Bacall. But less advice, I suppose, but certainly a cause to sit and reflect and think on very wise words from a much older lady at the time. She said, at the end of a take, I think it was, did she lean in and say to you, I'd give anything to be where you are now?
Oh, yeah,
and
that gives
you
me
say to her, it was a scene, wasn't it? And you say to her, where's that at? And she says, at the beginning.
Yeah.
I love that.
I love that. And that has always stayed with me. And she was an incredible woman to meet, because not only obviously she's such a legend in the acting world and in the world, but she was such a fearsome woman. I mean, when I worked with her, she was probably in her 80s, and it was an extraordinary job. She was on it. Angelica Houston was also in it, and Angelica Houston was her goddaughter. And so Angelica Houston was her goddaughter. There's also Terence Stamp.
In actual real life?
Real life, yeah. Angelica Houston's Lauren Bacall's goddaughter. So they had this incredible bond and loved each other, but also sort of told each other off constantly. I mean, Lauren did not shy away from a bit of a fight. I mean, she knew, that woman knew what she wanted, and she made sure everyone else knew it as well. So she was quite intimidating as a figure, and she took her time, she took her space, she would arrive on set every day, and she was obsessed with listening to the music of, she'd just been to see Hugh Jackman in Oklahoma on Broadway, and she was listening to the soundtrack on repeat, and so she had her earphones in, and before we could even start any scene, she would go around to every member of the crew and cast and make them listen to a little bit of Oklahoma on her earphones. And then she also, because she was enjoying it and she wanted everyone else to enjoy it, I think. And also she just got to a stage in her career where she was like, this is where I'm at, this is who I am, you know, and before I'm going to get down to work, I'm going to listen to a bit of Oklahoma. You should too. she was brilliant, and she was terrifying as well. I mean, you would not have crossed her, and I was young; I was in my early 20s, and you know, so bowled over by her. But that moment, her sort of turning around and saying, "I'd give anything to be where you are now," at the beginning, was sent chills down my spine, because of course I was at the beginning, and she was towards the end of her career, And it goes so quickly. You know, here I am now 20 years down the line from that moment, and talking to sort of the next generation coming up. And you do have to remember that feeling of what it was like to be at the beginning. And I think that's what she meant. I think she still did. I think she still remembered what it was like to be at the beginning. And she could, and that was in her bones. That was in her listening to Oklahoma. She loved it. She had that youthful vibrancy still. And it's so important to try and keep hold of that somehow.
It really is, isn't it? If we could bottle it, I'd drink it forever.
I know, of course, yeah.
It's all those kind of, you know, it's like first falling in love. It's first starting out and everything. You're not cynical then. You're just full of hope and great guts, actually, because with youth comes bravery.
That's it. And it is. And I think that's the same with acting. You know, I still get nervous. I'm so pleased when I start a job and I go, oh, I feel nervous, because it means that I still care about it. It means that I still want to do it. It means that I still have that same little buzz that I got, you know, on day one on that first job straight out of drama school. And I hope I never lose that, because if I do, then, you know, it'll be time to do something different. But I can't see that going any day
soon.
Well,
that takes me very nicely to my third and final question for
you.
Okay. You share a common bond with one of our previous guests, Luke Evans, who, like you, dared to be brave and pushy when it came to securing a role that went on to kind of change everything. You both wrote letters to casting directors telling them that you were the only person for the role that they were looking to fill. And in your case, it was your very first role straight out of drama school.
Yeah.
And you said previously there was an arrogance attached to the way that I got that job. I wrote to the casting director saying, "I am Nell Gwynn. You must cast me in this film. You'd be mad not to."
I know. Yeah.
So, I mean, I love that because Luke did exactly the same. He was about to quit acting. He'd done 10 years in musical theatre, wanted to play a straight role so he could progress his career from theatre to the screen, and just thought, "I've got nothing to lose." And it changed everything, as did that for you. I mean, that was your first step on the ladder.
Yeah.
So when else have you dared to be as bold, and how else has it played out for you when you have?
That was such a gutsy move, wasn't it? And I didn't.
Wasn't it?
And I didn't even.
Would you do it now?
I don't know. Possibly. I think there is that little sort of gutsy girl still in there, you know, waiting to get out
Lauren
at all
McCallwood.
Times. Lauren McCallwood. Oh, without question of a doubt, Lauren McCallwood. Yeah, maybe I would. I think perhaps, with age, you do become a little bit more reserved and a little bit more cynical. I think with that particular moment, there was a sort of naivety that I didn't really know how the industry worked. I was still at drama school. I didn't know how anything worked. I didn't know about casting directors. I didn't know about films. I didn't know, you know, there was so much sort of, I was so wide-eyed to everything. And I look back now and even I think there's a DVD, a friend of mine recently actually said, "Oh, I watched Stage Beauty the other day." And a part of me goes, "Oh God, did you? Goodness me, what's in that?" And she said, "There's a brilliant," oh, I shouldn't even say this, please don't look it up, but there's a brilliant DVD extra moment where you're just sort of rabbiting on about how excited you are to be on set. And I was like this, I thought I'd won the lottery. I was so excited. But apparently in this interview that I'm having on this sort of DVD extra, I'm just like, just brimming with enthusiasm, excitement, and just, you know, overflowing with it all. Fruit Everett Claire Danes, and I had a fruit bowl in my trailer, I've got a trailer, you know, just too much. It's just
like a competition winner.
Yeah. And
that's
it was such
brilliant.
It was brilliant. And you know, and also kind of it was such a sort of example of what the industry was going to do sort of down the line, because at the same time as I was doing that film, I was also still working my part-time job in a restaurant. So I would go, I'd get picked up in a car, and then I would be taken to the film set, and then I'd finish my 12-hour day and then come back and put my uniform on and go and work in the restaurant in the evening. I mean, I wouldn't do that now because I'd be exhausted. I can barely keep my eyes open past 10 o'clock. But yeah,
honestly, Zoe, you've got so much in common with Luke Evans, because he would do exactly the same. He was doing a West End show, but also to get the money up to go and do pilot season in Los Angeles was working the door at night at the Shadow Lounge. So he was a bouncer till like 4 a.m. So he'd come off stage at 10:30,
really
get there for 11, start his shift. But that was to save up the money to get out to Los Angeles to go and meet casting directors. And so, yeah, you share, you know, so
many.
Isn't
that wonderful, though? Isn't it wonderful that he did that and then now look at him? I mean, it's just...
And look at you.
Yeah, well, I think I do feel like, you know, you have to be bold in life. You do sometimes. And so when you ask me, would I do that again? I hope I would. I mean, I perhaps wouldn't do it in quite the sort of wide-eyed way I did it before, but I hope I still have that in me. And I suppose I do in a sort of slightly more cerebral way, because one thing I've done recently, which is I feel that sort of akin to that, is that during lockdown, I've always written, but I've never really thought that that would be a sort of string to my bow in a professional context. And then during lockdown, when
obviously in those early days when we didn't know if we were ever going to have a career again. And as a two-actor household, that we were like, what can you do? Gosh, I can't do anything else.
was it really that conversation?
Can you mow lawns? Like, what can you do? So I had been writing and I thought, well, maybe I need to be brave and actually show somebody my writing. And I had actually, when I was doing the one, that Netflix thing you spoke about, I'd had wonderful train journeys. And this is why I also love train journeys, because I had two young children at home. I was commuting during the week from London to Wales. And I just felt like I've got to use every single moment of my time productively, you know, pressure. And I would sit on the train and I wanted to write about my grandmother's upbringing in Grimsby during the 1950s, during the when Grimsby, of all places, was a sort of a really thriving, glamorous hotspot and fueled by the incredible fishing industry that they had.
Grimsby was a go-to destination.
Julie Andrews, Frank Sinatra sang there. It was a thriving hub of life. And no offense to Grimsby now, but it's not quite the same anymore.
No.
Which is
a real shame, because when you go to that part of the world, especially like Hull, for example, there's some beautiful buildings there.
Yeah.
You can see that it was once dazzlingly beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the industry there, unfortunately, has really suffered. But I was always fascinated by that era, and particularly sort of my grandmother's era. And my grandmother was a wonderful woman who I had a very close bond with. And what I loved about it particularly was that this sort of these dual lives that the women led, because they would, most of their lives were spent with other women because their men would be at sea fishing. And so they had these incredible communities of women around them that they helped each other, support each other, did all the jobs that the men did. And then for 3 days of, you know, they were called the 3 day millionaires, the fishermen then, because they used to make loads of money, but they'd only come to shore for 3 days every 12 weeks. And for 3 days, every 12 weeks, they'd come home and these women would dress themselves like Marilyn Monroe and they would go out on the tiles and they'd spend this money and they'd have these incredible wild times with their husbands. And then the men would go off to sea and it would be roll your sleeves up and get back to work again.
Fascinating.
And what happened during lockdown for me was that I'd always had that in my mind as something I wanted to write about. And I'd been researching it on my train journeys to Wales during the one. And then what I also did, as a lot of us did, is you know, watched everything on television during lockdown. And I had never watched Peaky Blinders. And I watched it from the beginning all the way through to the end and thought, why have I never seen this before? Because it's utterly wonderful. But what I also thought as I was watching it was, I've never seen women depicted like that on screen. I've never seen those bold, feisty female version of Peaky Blinders on our screen. That's what I want to be in. That's what I'm going to write. I'm going to write that. I'm going to get that little sort of Nell Gwynn part of me and go, I'm going to do that. I can be that. I'm going to do it. So I started writing and I wrote this script. But I was in my house homeschooling children, writing whenever I could, and I was terrified about showing it to anybody. But again, that little sort of voice inside my head went, you know, be bold, be brave, and I sent it off to a literary agent, and immediately they took me on. They took me on and said, "We love it. We absolutely love it. We're going to represent you." And from there on in, I'm now sort of forging this other path as a writer.
Well,
and I'm in development with a project right now with a wonderful production company. I still haven't quite got my fishing drama off the ground yet, but it's in my back pocket and it will be made. I feel certain of that at some stage. But that took guts for me to do that because it was a different sort of path for me, because I only ever thought I'm going to be an actress and that's all I want to do. And actually, I found something that I genuinely have just as much passion for, and that's kind of amazing.
Congratulations.
Look at Thank you.
Knocking it out of the park, homeschooling, doing Richie Swan's classes.
I'm not sure it's knocking it out of the park with homeschooling.
No, but you had a lot going on at that time, and you managed out of a really difficult time where, you know, like you say, you're a two-actor household. It must have been a genuine worry that, well, actually, you know, how are we going to feed the children?
Yeah.
Because we didn't know when we were going to go back to work, and you guys were the last back, really.
Yeah.
Amongst the last.
Yeah, well, we had, I think both of us didn't really work for a year. And then I got a job, and then actually Grace started during a lockdown, I think. We were doing Grace still while it was sort of the tricky COVID time. So yeah, it did all come back. But actually, you know, how wonderful to have kind of gained something else, confidence in another sort of area since. And you know, and that has been such a drive for me, you know, ever since. So it's been good.
Oh, carry on being brave and gutsy. I think you do it so well. I mean, that first letter you wrote, just to give people an idea of how effective it was, you graduated drama school on the Friday and started shooting that movie on something like the Monday, wasn't
it? Yeah, it was extraordinary. It was
because of that letter.
It was very annoying, I think, for the rest of my my year. I think they were, hang on, how did you manage that? But yeah, it was.
Well, some
was,
of them have gone on to do all right for themselves. You had Andrew Garfield in your year, didn't you?
Yeah, Spider-Man was one of our fellow team players.
But you beat him out of the trap, so
he's done okay. it was really magical. Actually, I don't often sort of think about that job these days. Although I was watching Claire Danes in Fleischman Is in Trouble. I don't know if you've seen that recently.
That's the book I'm reading at the moment, so I don't want to watch it until I've read the book. The book's really good.
The book's wonderful, and she is wonderful. And the adaptation has also been written by the same writer who wrote the book, and it's absolutely brilliant. It's I think you'll love it. If you're enjoying the book, you'll love the adaptation, the TV adaptation.
Does she play Rachel?
Yes. Yeah.
It depends
where you're at.
Book.
Well, I know. Okay. Yeah. I really can't say anything because there's a huge twist that you won't see coming, and I don't want to spoil it for you.
Oh, I can't wait for this train journey later. That's the big fat book I'm going
to
read.
You do have to read your book. Yeah, you have to.
I mean, literally, you think about it. Those first few jobs, you're playing opposite Rupert Everett with Billy Crudup, Claire Danes. Pretty much next job after that, Lauren Bacall, Angelica Houston. Actually, it takes great guts and bravery to hold your own on a set like that when you're literally about to go and do a shift in the evening as a waitress.
Well, it does and it doesn't. You know, you also have like just that sort of youthful ignorance, you know, just going, of course I'm going to come straight out of drama school and be straight onto a film set. You know, there was something so sort of naive about it. But I do remember kind of massive sort of moments of it was just being so surreal. I remember sitting one of the scenes, I had to dress up as King Charles II. So Rupert Everett played King Charles II. I was his mistress, Nell Gwynn. And I had to dress as King Charles and he had to dress as Nell Gwynn. And we were sitting on our thrones on, you know, some incredible set in Shepperton Studios. And there's hundreds of supporting artists everywhere. We were watching Claire Danes and Billy Crudup reenacting Othello on the stage in front of us. And Rupert Everett and I were just sat there looking at everybody and we were playing Snog, Marry, Kill. You know that game? Snog, Marry, Avoid, whichever one it is. And we were just literally sat there kind of in all of our costumes, me with my moustache and my great big wig, going, yeah, snog him, marry him. It's just so funny and so surreal. It was what a wonderful start to a career. And I'm very, very grateful for it. It's wonderful.
Oh, well, continued success in all that you do. I will, of course, see you back in Rich's Kitchen 10 a.m. Monday morning.
I will absolutely be there.
but I do hope that we get to actually look each other in the eye and not through a screen.
I know.
And meet one day. Let's make it happen. Should we take Rich out for dinner?
Let's take Rich out for dinner. And you're also good friends with Julie Graham, don't you?
Yeah. Do you know Jules as well?
Well, Julie, I don't know if we've got time to keep talking, but I should say this here because
I didn't survive us with Julie.
Well, I've worked with Julie twice, actually. Julie has had more of an impact on me as an actress than I think she realises, because I haven't seen Julie for a long time, and I probably should say this to her face rather than on a podcast, but when I first met Julie, we worked on a Miss Marple together, and she had just had her second daughter.
Sid, who's Sid, just turned 17.
He's just turned 17.
Can't believe it.
And I remember as a, you know, a young actress in my 20s, sort of getting up really early in the morning to go into, you know, to appear in costume drama, to go into makeup very early, to have my hair done and all the rest of it. And I remember walking into the makeup bus and seeing Julie sat there with her baby on her lap, breastfeeding. She had a copy of The Guardian in the other hand. She was regaling the makeup team with an incredible story and kind of putting the world to rights. And I remember kind of like sort of sliding into my seat next to her and like looking at her. I didn't know her at all. It's been my first day. And just thinking, who is this magnificent woman? And how do I get to be like her? And and I remember that so clearly. And then I had the you know, the good fortune to work with her again on Survivors for two series of that. And she just, she's just, well, you know her and love her, so I don't need to tell you, but she's just such a remarkable woman. She's such a strong, fierce advocate of other women.
She really is.
The way she sort of, she cares about people so deeply. And I remember that kind of vibe that she had on set, that she's got her eye on everybody and she's got everybody's back. And I thought, yes, that's what I'm going to do. That's if, you know, if I get to be, you know, as sort of successful as she is, I'm going to make sure that I'm that person for everybody as well. And you know, so she really is a huge role model to me. And I, yeah, I'm glad I've got the forum to say that, but I should definitely try and meet up and say it to her face as well.
You know what? She lives in Brighton. So
I know she does.
No,
I know, I've got no excuse. Next series starts next week.
She does listen to White Wine Question Time. By the way, everything you said about Jules, I endorse 100,000 times over.
Yeah.
She is quite the force.
She is.
And she has the talent and the intelligence and the empathy to be so many things to so many people. And she manages to do it all whilst raising two incredible young women on her own. You know, well, she had done at that time. I will make sure that Jules knows that we've had this conversation as well. I will send her this episode.
And I will see her when I start filming in Brighton again this year, because I'm back down there in April. So I'll have to meet up with her.
Grace continues. Yes.
We are starting season four in April. Yeah. Really soon.
Blimey.
So it's I think there's like 19 books Peter Jones has written. So, you know, fingers crossed, if everyone keeps watching, I'll be going to Brighton for some time yet.
Well, yeah, and also you'll know where your character, how she plays out, right? Because he's written the books already. It's not like one of those awful moments where you sit there and go, please,
I know,
God, don't let me be dead in this script.
She is in all 19 books, so fingers crossed they don't sort of decide to elbow me at any given opportunity.
Arzo, thank you. It has been a real pleasure to talk to you. And Grace is back. You can catch it on ITV1. But also on ITVX, stream the lot, binge it, don't leave the house. That's what I did.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
A huge thank you to Zoe. And don't forget, if you want to catch up on Grace, you can catch all previous episodes on ITVX, where it's streaming, and new episodes are dropping on ITV1 and ITVX any day now. And of course, if you want to hear more great chat with outstanding actors, you came to the right place. Get scrolling through that back catalogue. Luke Evans is in there, Mark Bonner, Julie Graham, Ralph Little, Hannah Waddingham, Alan Cumming, Jason Fleming, Griff Rhys-Jones, and so many more. And if Zoe's conversation around postnatal depression resonated with you and you'd like to hear more episodes where we discuss that in great detail, then Kate Lawler's episode and Denise Welsh's are also available. My thanks to you, as always, for listening in to Maria Nibbs and the Yahoo Studios team who produced the show with me. Editing is by Eleanor Humphrey and our music comes courtesy of Andy Bell. I'll be back next Friday with more great guests. Until then, thank you for your company.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The championship season is over, and what a season it was.
But the best is yet to come. It's the playoffs.
Who will make it to the Premier League?
And who will be left heartbroken at Wembley?
Stay across it all with the second tier.
We're bringing you episodes after every leg.
And in between, we're revisiting the greatest moments in playoff history.
It's real conversation with two real championship obsessives.
So you can be in the know about everything happening in the playoffs.
And share all your new knowledge in the pub with your mates.
So come join us.
We're your one-stop shop for the playoffs.
Search second tier in your podcast app
and hit subscribe.